Welcome in, everybody, to a deep dive into one of humanity's oldest mysteries, the soul. We're going on a journey through time, exploring how different cultures have tried to figure out what makes us, well, us. And to help us navigate this, we've got some fascinating academic excerpts. We'll be drawing from texts like Historia Pojechestotisish Omisu and Vustaptu Cogniti Wistiki.
It really is amazing to think how long people have been pondering this question. And even now, even today, the soul just, it sparks debate and captures our imagination.
It really does. It's a big one. So I guess for this deep dive, what are we doing here? Are we just going to try to define the soul?
Oh, it's so much more than a simple definition. Think of it more like we're tracing the evolution of this very, very powerful idea.
Okay, so how the concept of the soul has shaped things like philosophy and religion and even science.
Right, exactly. And also why... After all this time, why is there still so much mystery around it?
Yeah, why is that? Okay, well, let's rewind the clock all the way back, way, way back to the ancient world. Let's picture ourselves in ancient Mesopotamia or Egypt. These civilizations, I mean, they had some incredibly rich and nuanced ideas about the soul.
Yeah.
So what can you tell us about that?
One of the most striking things is that they didn't view the soul as this single unified entity like we often do today.
Right, right.
For them, it was more like a collection of different elements.
Okay.
Each with its own specific role to play.
So almost like different pieces fitting together to create a whole, a complete soul.
Okay.
Take the Egyptians, for example. They had the Kat, which was like the physical body.
Yeah.
But they believed it could transform into a spiritual body after death.
So it's not just the spirit that survives. They thought the physical form itself could be transformed.
That's right. And then you have the Ka.
Okay.
Which was kind of like a spiritual double of a person that still needed to be taken care of, even in the afterlife.
So almost like they thought that a part of you still wanted those things you enjoyed in life, even after death.
Right. Like they were packing a cosmic picnic basket for their Ka to enjoy in the afterlife or something.
Yeah.
I love that image. But one thing you mentioned earlier is that the ancient Egyptians... They didn't actually put much emphasis on the brain.
Yeah.
Which seems a bit odd to us now because, I mean, the brain is so central to how we think about the mind.
It is fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. They actually removed the brain during the mummification process, and they considered it relatively unimportant.
Well, the brain.
The heart, on the other hand.
Yes.
Was meticulously preserved. Mm. They saw it as the seat of intelligence and emotion.
That's so interesting. So, like, a completely different framework for understanding what makes us. Us. What about the ancient Greeks? I mean, they were known for their philosophical inquiries. Did they have different ideas about the soul?
They did, yeah. You had groups like the Pythagoreans who saw the soul as part of this universal harmony,
yeah.
That it was reflected in music and mathematics.
So almost like they believed that our very essence, like what makes us human, was somehow connected to the fundamental order of the cosmos, the universe.
Yeah, exactly.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
And of course, we can't forget Plato. I mean, his ideas about the soul, they're still incredibly influential even today.
Absolutely. I mean, Plato's view of the soul was groundbreaking. He believed that it was this pure, immortal form that was temporarily trapped inside the material body.
Uh-huh.
He even divided the soul into three different parts, the rational, the emotional, and the vegetative.
Right. I've heard about this three-part soul. Is there a connection between those three parts and Plato's idea of an ideal society like his republic?
Yeah, there is. He actually saw parallels between the three parts of the soul and the social classes in his republic. So the rational part, which should rule, was like the philosopher kings.
Okay.
The emotional part, which is associated with courage, was like the warriors.
Makes sense.
And then the vegetative part, which was concerned with kind of our basic needs, was like the working class.
Oh, interesting. So for Plato, individual well-being was linked to this idea of social harmony. And they were both rooted in this proper ordering of the soul.
Exactly.
It all comes back to the soul.
Wow.
But, I mean, how did he explain this complex idea? I mean, in a way that, you know, normal people could understand.
He used metaphors, powerful metaphors. And one of the most famous is the image of the soul as a charioteer.
Okay.
Who's trying to control these two horses.
Right.
And one horse represents reason. It's striving for wisdom and virtue.
Okay.
And the other one represents our desires, the things that are pulling us towards earthly pleasures.
Oh, so our inner life is like this constant struggle between these two forces.
Exactly.
And do you think that resonates with people even today? I mean,
I think it does. I mean, we all experience that inner conflict between our better impulses and our more base desires, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing how these ancient ideas, I mean, they still speak to us across millennia. I mean, it's just incredible.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's fast forward a bit. Let's move on to the Middle Ages. So how did the rise of Christianity kind of impact this understanding of the soul?
This is where things get really interesting. The church fathers, they were grappling with this challenge of trying to integrate these ancient philosophical ideas about the soul with Christian teachings. They had to make these spiritual concepts fit into a world that was, you know, increasingly being understood through this more material lens.
Oh, so like a delicate balancing act. Did they run into any specific challenges when they were trying to reconcile those two different perspectives?
They did. One example is this question of angels.
Okay.
If angels were these purely spiritual beings, mm-hmm. how could they possibly eat angels' food, like what's described in the Bible?
Right.
You know, it raises all these questions about, you know, what's the relationship between the spiritual and material realms?
That's such a good example.
Yeah.
I mean, it really highlights the struggle to reconcile these kind of abstract spiritual concepts with the concrete realities of, you know, the physical world. But I mean, someone must have come along to try to synthesize these different views, right?
You're right. One of the most influential figures during this period was St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah.
And his massive work, Summa Theologica, I mean, it really had a profound impact on how the church understood the soul.
I've heard of Summa Theologica, but it's known for being like incredibly dense and complex. So how did Aquinas even approach this question of the soul?
Well, he drew heavily on Aristotle's concept of hylomorphism.
Hylomorphism.
Which yeah. is, I know, a bit of a mouthful.
Yeah.
But essentially, it means that the soul is the form of the body.
Okay, so instead of the soul being this kind of separate ghostly entity, it's more like it's the organizing principle that gives the body life and purpose.
Exactly.
Okay.
Think of it like this.
Yeah.
You have a lump of clay.
Oh, yeah.
That's the matter, like the body.
Mm-hmm.
But to make it into a vase, you need a potter to come and shape it, to give it form.
Right.
The soul, for Aquinas, is that form-giving principle.
I love that. That's a really helpful way to understand it. But did Aquinas's views actually fully resolve all the debates about the soul?
Not quite. Even Aquinas had to grapple with some really tricky theological questions. Like, where exactly is the soul located?
Right.
And how can it be immortal if it's so intertwined with this physical body? I mean, these were questions that people debated fiercely.
So even with Aquinas' brilliant synthesis, I mean, the mystery of the soul, it kind of endured. Were there any other notable figures during this time who challenged the prevailing views about the soul?
There were. One really fascinating case is Pietro Pomponazzi,
yeah.
a philosopher who actually dared to argue that the intellect, a key part of the soul, might be mortal.
Wow. That's pretty bold, right? Especially considering, you know, the power of the church at the time.
Mm-hmm.
What was his reasoning behind that?
He believed that the intellect depended on the physical brain.
Okay.
So if the brain dies, the intellect dies with it. This directly challenged the church's doctrine of the soul's immortality.
So we're starting to see these seeds of conflict, you know, between faith and reason, between this religious dogma and scientific inquiry. And it seems like that tension's only going to, you know, intensify in the centuries to come.
Absolutely. As we move into the 16th century, we see this clash become even more pronounced.
Okay.
As new scientific discoveries start to challenge these long-held assumptions about the soul and how it relates to the body.
That's a great place to stop for now.
Yeah.
What do you think, listeners? Are you starting to see how this concept of the soul has been shaped by, I mean, the prevailing ideas of each era? It's a journey through history, through philosophy, and even science, all wrapped up in this one big question.
And we've only just scratched the surface.
So we left off talking about this huge shift in how people thought about the soul.
Yeah.
Moving to the 16th century. And it seems like scientific inquiry is starting to challenge some of those traditional religious views of the soul that we talked about last time.
Right. And this is where we see the relationship between the intellect and the senses really come to the forefront.
Okay.
And one figure who exemplifies this is Luis Vives. He was really interested in how emotions influence our intellect.
That sounds so relevant to modern psychology. I mean, we understand now how intertwined our emotions and our thoughts really are.
It is, right. And in fact, Vives' work foreshadows some modern concepts like embodied cognition. This idea that the mind isn't this detached entity, but it's deeply connected to our physical bodies and our experiences in the world.
So instead of the mind being this disembodied spirit floating around somewhere, it's more like it's something that's shaped by our interactions with the world around us.
That's exactly it. And this shift towards a more embodied understanding of the mind really sets the stage for one of the most influential figures in Western philosophy.
Oh, I know who you're going to say. Descartes, right?
Yes.
The I think, therefore I am guy. So what was his take on the soul?
Well, Descartes is most known for his theory of mind-body dualism.
Okay.
He argued that there were two distinct substances in the universe.
Okay.
Res extensa, which is basically all material things.
Okay, the physical stuff.
The physical stuff. And res cogitans, which is the realm of thinking things.
So the mind. So for Descartes, the mind and body were just fundamentally different.
Yeah, totally separate.
Did he believe that animals had souls? Or was that something unique to humans?
Descartes believed that only humans had true minds. And that's because only humans have language. He saw language as the key differentiator. It was a sign of a rational soul.
But not everyone agreed with Descartes, I imagine.
Of course not. I mean, his idea sparked a huge debate.
Yeah.
And one of his most vocal critics was Julien Aufray de Lemaître, a physician and philosopher who had a very different, quite radical view of the soul.
Okay, what did Lemaître propose?
Well, he wrote this really controversial book. It was called Man a Machine. And in it, he argued that all those things that we usually attribute to the soul, like thoughts and feelings and even our will, are actually products of the body's mechanics.
So he's basically saying we're complex machines, but machines nonetheless. No immaterial soul needed. I bet that caused quite a stir.
Oh, yeah, it did. It was a pretty shocking idea at the time. And he believed that humans differed from animals only in the degree of complexity of our machinery. Not some fundamental essence or soul. He even suggested that if we could build a machine that was sophisticated enough, it could potentially think and feel just like we do.
Wow, that's really prescient. I mean, considering all our conversations now about AI, he was way ahead of his time.
He was. And in a lot of ways, his work foreshadows modern comparative psychology.
Okay.
Which is all about exploring the similarities and differences between human and animal minds.
So we're seeing this gradual shift away from a purely spiritual understanding of the soul and towards something more grounded in the physical world. But what about life itself? How did scientists in the 18th century explain the difference between, like, living organisms and inanimate objects?
That's where vitalism comes in. This was a school of thought that struggled to explain complex biological processes, you know, things like embryonic development, just through purely mechanistic explanations. So they proposed this existence of a vital force.
So some unseen force that animates living beings.
Right. Something beyond just physics and chemistry.
Was this vital force, was it considered the same thing as a soul?
Not necessarily. I mean, the concept of this vital force was more about explaining the unique properties of life itself. Whereas the soul was often seen as something more connected to consciousness, you know, maybe even immortality. But I think the two ideas definitely overlapped in some ways.
I can see how that would be a tempting explanation, especially when you're faced with the incredible complexity of life. Did it hold up as science advanced?
You know, as scientists made more progress in understanding the chemical and physical processes of life, the need for this mysterious vital force kind of started to diminish.
Okay.
I mean, the more they could explain through observation and experimentation, the less they needed to rely on these unseen forces.
So we're seeing this trend continuing, right? This movement away from explanations rooted in the spiritual or the unseen and towards those based on empirical evidence on what we can actually see and measure. It's almost like the soul is slowly retreating as science illuminates more the natural world.
That's a great way to put it. And this shift really accelerates in the 19th and 20th centuries. We enter this period where science really starts to flex its muscles, and all those age-old philosophical debates about the soul, they kind of take a backseat to the study of the brain and behavior.
Right. We're moving from the realm of metaphysics into the realm of neuroscience and psychology.
Exactly. And one of the most influential figures in this transition is Donald Hebb.
Okay.
A Canadian psychologist. And he made this, well, rather provocative statement.
What do you say?
He said, psychology operates under the working hypothesis that the soul does not exist.
Whoa. Okay. That's a pretty strong statement. Is he saying that science has, like, definitively proven that there's no such thing as a soul?
Not quite. It's important to understand that this was a methodological assumption, not like a dogmatic denial. He was essentially saying that for the purposes of scientific inquiry, it's more productive to focus on what we can actually observe and measure.
So things like brain activity and behavior, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. By focusing on these very tangible aspects of the mind, we can learn a whole lot, even if we can't definitively prove or disprove the existence of something like a soul.
So it's not about, like, denying the soul outright, but more about shifting the focus of inquiry towards what we can actually investigate scientifically.
Right.
But does that mean that science has nothing to say about the soul at all?
No, not at all. There are still ways to think about the soul within a scientific framework. For example, we talked about hylomorphism earlier.
Right.
The idea that the soul is the form of the body.
Right, Aquinas's view.
Right.
But how does that fit with modern neuroscience?
Well, some contemporary neuroscientists have suggested that we could think of the soul as the specific form of the brain.
Okay.
Meaning the unique pattern of neural connections, the way our neurons are arranged and how they communicate with each other.
So rather than this separate immaterial entity, the soul is more like an emergent property of the physical brain, something that arises from this complex interplay of all its parts.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it.
Okay.
It's still a very complex concept, of course, and we're far from fully understanding how the material brain gives rise to subjective experience. But this perspective, at least, allows us to kind of integrate the idea of a soul with what we know about neuroscience.
So it's like the soul has gone from this grand metaphysical concept to something a little more tangible, something we can actually study and investigate.
Right.
What does that mean for the idea of the soul's immortality, though, if it's so closely tied to the physical brain?
That's a question that people continue to debate. Some argue that as our scientific understanding of the brain advances, the traditional concept of an immaterial, immortal soul might become, I don't know, less and less relevant.
Like it's slowly fading away and being replaced by a more scientific understanding of the mind.
In a way, yeah. Some philosophers use the phrase empty name to describe this phenomenon. It's kind of like the concept of ether in physics.
Oh, you mean the stuff they thought filled the universe?
Yeah.
But then it turned out it doesn't exist.
Exactly. We still use the word ether metaphorically, but it doesn't actually refer to any scientifically valid concept anymore. And maybe the same thing will happen with the soul. The word might stick around, but its meaning might change as our understanding of the brain evolves.
So even as science sheds new light on how the mind works, we're still left with some pretty profound mysteries. But how did we even begin to study something as elusive as the mind in the first place? It seems like such a difficult thing to, like, grasp scientifically.
It is. And in the early days of psychology, researchers relied heavily on introspection.
Okay.
Basically means looking inward and trying to observe your own mental processes.
Like trying to catch your own thoughts in the act.
Yes, exactly. And pioneers like Wilhelm Wundt and William James, they believed that introspection could provide this window into how the mind worked.
But I imagine there are some limitations with that approach. I mean, our own perceptions can be so biased and unreliable.
Exactly. And that's what later researchers found. Introspection, while it can be useful to some degree, turned out to be highly subjective and vulnerable to all sorts of cognitive biases.
So what happened? Did psychologists just give up on studying the mind?
No, not at all. This realization led to a shift towards behaviorism.
Okay.
And this was a school of thought that said, okay, let's focus on what we can actually observe, behavior. So instead of trying to directly study consciousness, behaviorists studied how organisms learn and respond to stimuli in their environment.
So it was a way to make the study of the mind a little more scientific, a little more objective.
Exactly.
And even behaviorists. I mean, they couldn't ignore the fact that a lot of our mental life happens below the level of conscious awareness, right?
Right. And that's where the concept of the unconscious comes in. Most famously explored, probably, by Sigmund Freud.
Right. Freud, the name everyone knows. His theories are a little controversial these days, but how did he view the unconscious?
Well, Freud believed that the unconscious mind was basically a repository of all these primal drives and repressed memories and unresolved conflicts. And he argued that these unconscious forces could powerfully influence our thoughts and feelings, even if we weren't directly aware of them.
So, like, there's this whole hidden world inside our minds that's shaping our behavior in ways that we don't fully understand.
Mm-hmm.
That's both kind of fascinating and a little unsettling at the same time.
It is. And Freud's ideas, I mean, they had a huge impact on, you know, psychology and art and literature, well, even popular culture. I mean, he opened up this whole new way of thinking about human nature.
It's like he pulled back the curtain on the stage of our minds and revealed all this behind-the-scenes action that we're usually oblivious to.
That's a great analogy. And it's important to remember that even those who disagree with Freud's specific theories still acknowledge the importance of these unconscious processes.
So we're starting to see this really complex picture emerge. You know, the mind is not just what we're consciously aware of. It's this multifaceted thing with hidden depths and unseen forces at play.
Absolutely.
And this complexity just deepens as we delve further into the workings of the brain. Did you know that a Russian physiologist named Ivan Sekhanov actually faced censorship for his idea that all actions, you know, conscious or unconscious, are basically just reflexes?
Really?
Yeah. So he was saying that even our most deliberate actions are ultimately governed by, like, these automatic physiological processes.
Yeah, exactly. And his work was incredibly prescient. I mean, it really foreshadowed modern views of the brain as this intricate network of interconnected neurons.
Right.
You know, constantly firing and transmitting signals that ultimately determine our behavior.
It's mind-boggling to think that everything we do, everything we feel and experience, can be traced back to, like, the activity of these tiny cells in our brains.
Mm. It really is. And as our understanding of the brain has advanced, this view has gained even more support. Thomas Huxley, who was a prominent biologist and a supporter of Darwin's theory of evolution, famously argued that we are conscious automata.
So we have free will in the sense that we can choose to act on our desires.
Yeah.
But ultimately, we're still bound by the laws of physics and biology.
That's the essence of his argument. And it's a view that's still debated today. But it really highlights the challenge of reconciling our subjective experience of free will with this, you know, increasingly mechanistic view of the brain that science is revealing.
It's like we're caught between these two competing narratives, right?
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, we feel like we're in control, making choices, shaping our own destinies. But on the other hand, science seems to be suggesting that our actions are ultimately determined by this, like, complex machinery of our brains.
Right. And that tension is really at the heart of a lot of the contemporary debates about consciousness and free will and the nature of the self. It's a tension that we haven't fully resolved, but it's a testament to the power of this concept of the soul to keep sparking debate and to drive inquiry.
Yeah, even as this traditional religious understanding of the soul seems to be fading, those questions it raised about the nature of consciousness and the human experience, I mean, they remain just as relevant as ever.
They do.
And I'm excited to see where this journey takes us. But before we delve further into those mysteries, I want to hear a little bit more about some of the pioneers who were trying to understand these unconscious processes. You mentioned Benjamin Carpenter earlier.
Yes.
Who was studying how our minds can actually learn and adapt without us even knowing it, without our conscious awareness. Can you tell me a little bit more about his work?
Yeah. Carpenter was really fascinated by the idea that learning could take place without conscious effort. He called it unconscious cerebration. And one of his key observations was that these unconscious biases could really affect our behavior.
That's so relevant today, given all the conversations we're having about implicit bias and its impact on society.
Absolutely. And Carpenter's work really laid the groundwork for later research on unconscious processing and its role in everything from perception to decision making.
So even though we might not be aware of it, our unconscious mind is constantly at work, kind of shaping our perceptions, guiding our actions.
Exactly. And his work ties in nicely with the work of Hermann Helmholtz.
Okay.
A brilliant physicist and physiologist who made groundbreaking discoveries in the field of perception.
So what was Helmholtz's big contribution?
Helmholtz was really intrigued by the fact that our perception of the world is not this simple, passive process. He argued that it actually requires unconscious inference.
Unconscious inference. What does that mean? Is our brain, like, making things up?
In a way, yes. Our brains are constantly filling in the gaps, making assumptions and constructing this coherent picture of the world based on the limited sensory information that they receive.
So it's not just about, like, seeing or hearing things. It's about interpreting them.
Yeah.
And making sense of them
yeah.
based on our, you know, prior experiences and expectations.
Precisely. Helmholtz was really a pioneer in understanding how active and constructive the process of perception really is.
It's almost like our brains are running this, like, background program that we're not even aware of, constantly shaping and refining our experience of reality.
That's a great way to put it.
Wow.
And his work really anticipated the rise of cognitive science, which basically views the mind as this information processing system.
So we're moving even further away from this idea of the soul as a disembodied entity and towards a more computational, almost algorithmic understanding of the mind.
Yes. And this shift leads us to another intriguing figure, Paul MacLean.
Okay.
And his famous triune brain model.
Oh, the triune brain.
Yeah.
I've heard of this. It's the idea that our brains are basically made up of three distinct parts, right?
Right. So MacLean proposed that the human brain is essentially three brains in one.
Okay.
You have the reptilian brain, the mammalian brain, and the human brain.
And each of those has a different function.
Exactly. So the reptilian brain, which is the oldest part evolutionarily, is responsible for all those basic survival instincts, like breathing and heart rate.
Okay.
The mammalian brain, which developed a little bit later, is associated with emotions and social behavior. And then finally, the human brain, the neocortex, is the seat of higher cognitive functions like language and reasoning.
It's almost like a history of evolution etched into the structure of our brains.
Right. And what's fascinating is that MacLean linked these three brain structures to Freud's famous tripartite model of the psyche, you know, the id, the ego, and the superego.
Oh, wow. So the reptilian brain is like the id. Driven by those primal urges, the mammalian brain is like the ego, mediating between those urges and the demands of reality.
Yeah.
And the human brain is like the superego, striving for morality and higher ideals.
That's the basic idea. And while MacLean's model has been, you know, criticized for being a bit oversimplified, it still provides this fascinating link between brain structure and these psychological concepts.
It's a reminder that our minds aren't just these abstract entities. They're embodied, they're rooted in the physical structures of our brains.
Exactly.
And when we delve deeper into those structures, we just keep uncovering new mysteries, new layers of complexity that challenge our understanding of what it means to be human.
It's an ongoing journey of discovery, and we're only just beginning to map the uncharted territories of the mind.
It feels like we've been on this incredible journey. You know, we started with those ancient beliefs about the soul, and now we're talking about, like, neuroscience and the intricate workings of the brain. But where does all this leave us? I mean, have we actually answered the question, what is the soul?
Well, that's the thing about these deep dives, right? Sometimes the deeper you go, the more you realize how much more there is to explore. Like, we may never fully grasp the mysteries of the mind.
It's like we're trying to solve this ancient puzzle. But every time we put a piece in place, we discover a whole new section that we didn't even know existed.
Exactly. And some philosophers argue that our very way of thinking about the mind might actually be part of the problem.
All right.
They point to this concept of folk psychology.
Folk psychology.
Yeah. It's basically our everyday intuitive understanding of how people think and behave.
So the way we typically talk about, like, beliefs and desires and intentions.
Yes, exactly. And thinkers like Gilbert Ryle, they suggested that this folk psychology, it might not actually reflect how the mind really works.
Okay.
He saw the mind as more of a way of kind of organizing and making sense of our actions and our experiences rather than like this separate, you know, ghostly entity.
So instead of the mind being this thing that causes our behavior,
right,
it's more like it's a way of describing our behavior.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's a subtle distinction, but it's an important one.
Okay.
And it challenges that traditional mind-body dualism that we've been talking about.
Okay, so if this folk psychology, if this isn't quite right, are there other ways of thinking about the mind that kind of fit better with what we know about neuroscience?
There are. And this is where we get into some more radical philosophical territory. Things like a limitative materialism.
Limitative materialism.
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds intense.
It is. It's a view that says we should just get rid of, like, we should eliminate mentalistic terms from our vocabulary completely.
Wow.
Because they don't correspond to any real physical phenomena.
So instead of talking about things like beliefs and desires,
yeah,
we should just stick to describing brain states and neural processes.
Exactly. And it's a pretty controversial position, as you can imagine.
I can imagine, yeah.
It kind of implies that our subjective experience, the way things feel to us, isn't really real in the way that we usually think about it.
Yeah, that's a hard one to accept. Are there any, like, less extreme views that kind of try to bridge that gap between, you know, our subjective experience and the scientific understanding of the brain?
Yeah, there are. Another position is known as reductive materialism.
Okay.
And this aims to kind of reduce mental phenomena to physical phenomena, but without completely eliminating that mentalistic language.
So we can still talk about beliefs and desires, but we understand them as ultimately rooted in brain activity.
Exactly. It's like trying to find the neural correlates of consciousness to map out how those specific patterns of brain activity give rise to our thoughts and our feelings.
It's amazing. Science is constantly pushing the boundaries of what we thought was possible. But even with all these advancements, it still feels like there's this sense of awe and mystery surrounding the mind.
Absolutely. And that's what makes this whole field so captivating. You know, the pursuit of knowledge continues. But I think it's also important to acknowledge the limits of what we can know.
Yeah. I totally agree. Well, we've covered so much in this deep dive, from ancient beliefs to, modern neuroscience. I think we've explored how this concept of the soul has shaped how we think as humans, and also how it continues to evolve in light of new discoveries.
It's been an incredible journey, and I think it leaves us with this, with a final provocative question to ponder.
Yeah, one second.
Does the decline of this traditional soul concept in science, does it actually diminish its significance in human experience, or does it kind of invite us to explore new ways of understanding the relationship between our physical and our mental selves?
That's a really great question, and one I think is worth pondering. I encourage you, dear listeners, to keep exploring this fascinating topic. Even without, definitive answers, the very act of inquiry, I think it enriches our understanding of ourselves and our place in the cosmos.
It's a journey that never truly ends.
Well said. Well, until next time, keep seeking that knowledge and keep asking those big questions.